Inside Crime is brought to you by A Block Media, a full-service consulting firm specializing in media solutions for the law enforcement community. Law enforcement professionals know A Block is a partner they can trust. I'm Angeline Hartman. As a journalist, I've worked with cops and victims of crime all over the country. My craft is storytelling. My passion is crime fighting. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Inside Crime. 1 week ago today, we began our second season with the story of an unidentified little boy found at a cemetery in DeKalb County, Georgia. It was 20 years to the day he was discovered. 20 years of searching for his name.
Routinely, when you get an unidentified subject, whether it's a male, female, it's usually Cliff or Jane Doe or John Doe. John Doe, of course, male, Jane Doe meaning female. And sometimes, in this case, it was originally Clifton Doe, meaning the area town in which was found, and then Doe meaning unidentified.
Patrick Bailey is the director of the DeKalb County Medical Examiner's Office.
Because this is a child, and this is office is always taking proactive measures in regards to children-related cases, a decision was made in-house to give him a name. That's so it gives us a personality, someone to look at. It gives us some semblance of he's somebody. Adults do things or end up in positions that which may or may contribute to the death. This child was innocent, in our opinion. And we wanted to give him a name, give him a face, so to speak. So it was kicked around. Dennis the Menace was something that came up because he always got into things. And I think Dennis stuck.
For now, his name is Dennis. Forensic experts believe the unidentified African-American child was between 5 to 7 years old. But investigators want you to keep an open mind. They say it's possible he was as young as 4 years old. On the 20-year mark since the discovery of Dennis's skeletal remains, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children released a new image of what he may have looked like in life. After last week's podcast release and all of the renewed media attention, Director Bailey tells me they received a number of calls from the public, and investigators are now following up on those leads.
We've had leads when people have seen images in the past, and they've called, and a good many of those have led to, have been leads that we've already considered, relooked at, and then ruled out. So you may have recalled something and thought it to be odd and just didn't consider it. Don't consider it to be odd or don't discount it. Call us. It may be something explainable. It may be routine for whoever was in the area, but let us rule that out because what you don't call us on may be the actual lead that leads to an identification.
When I covered this case in the early years of the investigation, there was one lead cops shared publicly, hoping to get more information. It was a call from a woman in Florida who said she knew the little boy and his parents. For this podcast, I interviewed several of the original investigators, and they all told me the same thing. After all of these years, that one call remains the most promising lead in this case. The call came in on Tuesday, October 12, 1999, about 8 months after Dennis was found. A woman called the medical examiner's office, and she was emotional.
That particular day, the best thing I remember, we're talking 20 years ago. That particular day, secretary said she had a call come in from a lady that wanted to talk to us about the missing child.
Jim Mabe is a retired forensic investigator. In 1999, he was working at the DeKalb County Medical Examiner's Office and took the call.
She was already upset when I picked up the phone. Now, I don't know what the secretary heard, but when she transferred the call to me, I identified myself as a Jim Mabe, a forensic investigator with the Medical Examiner's Office. What can I do for you? And she was genuinely upset at the time that she made the phone call. And she said, you're like, oh my God, I know who this is.
Jim told me the woman called saying she recognized the child after seeing his image. It's unclear if she saw the little boy's face on the news or maybe a flyer, but she was certain that she knew him. She said his name was Cabell Brown, that his parents frequently visited Florida, and he went missing in 1999.
The initial call was probably 2 or 3 minutes. Until it was at that point I determined I just can't understand what you're saying. And it wasn't because she was so excited and just talking so fast that I couldn't understand it. It was just the noise, the background. She was upset, obviously, but not to the point of being incoherent. The background noise that was created by the people in the background, I just couldn't understand her. But I told her, so let me transfer the phones and see if I can understand you. Now, it's possible she got scared when I said I was going to transfer the phones, thinking I'm going to record the conversation, and she didn't want to record it. She didn't say that. But why would she hang up? If she was that upset, she knew who this child was, she would be anxious to continue our conversation, but she didn't. And either technically he got disconnected or she just simply hung up the phone. But we just don't know.
The call ended before Jim could find out anything else. What was the woman's connection to the child, to his parents? Where did they live? Even without those answers, the woman left a strong impression on Jim.
As a homicide detective and as a forensic death investigator, you talk to people all the time, and you get this sense of, are they sincere about what they're saying or what? And you can imagine, just imagine this. You're at home, you're watching the news or you're reading the newspaper, and all of a sudden you see somebody that's unidentified and you go, golly, I know that person. And you're going to get excited about it. You want to help if you can. That's the impression that I got from her. I didn't get any impression that she was crying or anything. She was just wanting to get it out real quick that I know this child. Boy, this is the story behind this child, et cetera, and so on. And I believed her at this point. There was no reason to not believe her. She wasn't, you know, asking to fame or fortune or money or anything. She was simply, I know it. Here's, and when she gave me the name, that kind of put the topping on the cake, if you will.
Jim keeps mentioning that background noise in the call. It's a detail that will be explained shortly. Right now, I want you to hear from another investigator.
That was probably one of the most solid leads that we had had. It was one of the few that everything kind of lined up on it.
Woody Hall was the deputy chief investigator with the medical examiner's office when this case began.
You know, she dropped off and we never got back in touch with her or found anything, but she did identify herself. She gave a name.
That female caller gave a name that day. All of these years, investigators never released that name publicly, hoping she would call back, hoping her name would pop up again. That didn't happen. So I asked the medical examiner's office to consider releasing her name now. After 20 years, could this woman with key information still be out there? Investigators say the answer is yes. Her name was Dawn Anderson.
With that information, we went through our sources over at the police department and tracked down the phone number, and it came back to the Florida Institute of Technology.
The Florida Institute of Technology is located in Melbourne, Florida, about 75 miles southeast of Orlando. Woody Hall and a detective from DeKalb County Police traveled to Florida together, following the trail, searching for Dawn Anderson.
So we made contact with Brevard County down there and their ME and so on and so forth. And we went down there and we're going to find this phone. And as we went to the campus and started going, we found the phone. And it was a phone that was on a wall in the student center. And then our hopes got up. So we said, okay, we got the phone. And it was an unusual phone. It was like it had a speaker that was built into the wall, and you actually talked into this speaker as opposed to a handset, so it was a little different. And that was the reason that all this background noise was involved in the conversation that Jim had had.
That phone wasn't a typical payphone. Just picture an intercom box on a building wall where you talk into a speaker. Finding the phone was just one piece of the puzzle. It turned out there was no Don Anderson enrolled at the school.
We're sitting there, and here we are in Florida, and we're standing at the phone knowing that somebody identifying themselves as so-and-so actually used this phone to call our office, you know, several months after all the initial news had been out there. And we thought, oh, this is great. This is great. So, you know, you're scanning because it's like everything else. You're looking in the student center and you're looking at all these young faces and things. And you're thinking, which one are you called, you know?
It was a student center, and it housed the student center, the cafeteria, and the student mailboxes. Specifically, it was building 412 based on my notes.
Greg Padrick was the detective who traveled with Woody Hall to Florida. Greg is now an assistant chief with DeKalb County Police. He remembers that trip very well for many reasons.
Where did the strip clubs come in?
What we had learned was that Don Anderson or a person by the name of Don Anderson may have been a dancer in the area. So we went to several of the locations trying to identify any dancers by the name of Don Anderson. And that was significant to me as, you know, as a young officer. This was, I believe, my first, you know, travel on duty for on duty purposes. And to have to go to those type of establishments to identify a witness or a potential witness was significant to me. And it was something that I recollect, you know, pretty freshly because it was such an odd occurrence.
The dancer lead didn't pan out that day, but Greg says they came up with two Melbourne addresses for two separate Don Andersons and found one of them.
We're able to interview her and her boyfriend. He stated that he and Don have been together for approximately 4 years. We finally made contact with this specific Don Anderson, and she stated that she had never been to Atlanta or Georgia at all. She also stated that she had never been to or attended the Florida Institute of Technology. But she did have a friend who lived in Lawrenceville, Georgia, but she was not familiar with the phone call and she did not remember anyone who would use her name. When we had contact with this female, I felt like she had more information than she was leading on. I didn't know if maybe because her boyfriend was there at the location, she didn't want to elaborate on what she may have known. But at any rate, she didn't give us any new information and she denied making the phone call at the time.
She said she had no connection to that school. Is that correct?
That's correct. She said she had no connection with the school, but she did attend a community college that was in the area. We did further research within the university system and the library cards. We wanted to research to see if this person, Dawn Anderson, had ever used her library card at the Florida Institute of Technology. She had stated that she attended school at Brevard Community College. Both cards are accepted at both colleges, but there was no evidence to indicate that she had used her library card at either location.
Investigator after investigator has said, you know, this call is the strongest lead that came in during that time. And there are things that could have been followed up. What's your take on that call?
Yeah, I think this call was the strongest lead. And, you know, looking back, I don't see anything that we could have done differently in order to identify the caller and pursue more information in relation to the case. I feel strongly that the first Don Anderson that we talked to had more information than what she was leading on. Again, her asking for our cards and asking for our numbers was significant to me because if it was out of the blue or out of the ordinary for her, she wouldn't have any reason to follow up with Investigator Hall or myself. So the fact that she was asking for our contact information so that she could check around and follow up made me believe that she had more information than she was leading on at the time. However, we never did hear from her.
You thought you might hear from her after a while?
Yes.
Whenever she was more comfortable talking to you.
Yes, that was my hope.
And that's what investigators are hoping for now. By releasing the name Don Anderson, can that somehow lead to the woman with information? She said his name was Cabell Brown, But remember, there was a lot of background noise. Was his name Cabell? Or did she say Caleb? Investigators know the call was made on a Tuesday morning. People on campus that day may have seen a woman who was upset using that speakerphone at the student center. Do you know anyone who attended the Florida Institute of Technology in 1999? The answers are out there. Coming up next on Inside Crime, could someone's curiosity about their family history lead to those answers?
It's taking another old tool that people have used for centuries, and with new DNA technologies, instead of writing down everybody's family histories and descendants, they're now using DNA to find each other. And now it's being applied very recently to forensic cases.
What's next in this investigation? That's coming up on the next episode of Inside Crime. Inside Crime is produced by A Block Media. For more information about this episode and to see photographs of that campus phone, check out our website, insidecrime.com. Feel free to drop me an email too. I would love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening. I'm your host, Angeline Hartman. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode of Inside Crime.